Johnson succeeded President John F. Kennedy in 1963, Diem had been murdered and the situation was falling apart. In 1964, Johnson convinced Congress to pass the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, giving him complete power to act as he saw necessary in Vietnam. In 1965, he authorized the deployment of the first U.S. combat troops and a bombing campaign.
In order to have 150,000 combat troops sent to Vietnam, there had to be an energizing of the draft system. At that time, students, both undergraduate and graduate students, were deferred from military service. Now, the first step was to withdraw that exemption from undergrads. The exemption was taken away from graduate students about a year later. This created a lot of frustration in students and in their families who had saved money for them to go to school, and that was going to be taken away. The draft was an interesting phenomenon. Everybody had to sign up when you were 18. Everybody, all males. And if you didn't, that was a federal felony and you were going to go to jail. Your 12th graders were going to have to sign up. They were given a number, and the numbers were placed in a container. The container would be shaken up. So many names had to be drawn each month, and somebody would reach in that container and pull out a ping pong ball with that number on it, and they would name off the numbers. And if your number came up, you had 30 days to report. Life became very uncertain for both undergrad and graduate students, and probably a little shaky for high school people.
Before the lottery, your grades had to do with whether you would be draft eligible or not. And so if you had less than a C average, you became draftable. So professors just gave everybody A's because they didn't want to be complicit in getting people drafted. The word grade inflation ran concurrent at that time because who wanted to flunk somebody if that was going to get them drafted?
When the troops built up, when Johnson sent over 500,000 U.S. troops to Vietnam and we had a full-flown war, and then Kennedy and then Nixon came in and they were bombing Cambodia and about every country around Vietnam, then, you know, people were refusing to be drafted. They were being sent to prison. They were being sent or going to Canada. So many times you'd sit around in the cafeteria with a young man and saying what was his draft status and what was he likely to want to do. Would he let them induct them into the military? Would he leave for Canada? So we had lots of conversations of how you become a landed immigrant in Canada, some people Sweden, some people be draft resistors and say no and go to federal prison. There were people here who went to, I think they sent them to Sandstone Prison in Minnesota for evading the draft. So it was very personal.
When I was growing up, there were people talking about why the war wasn't right and that we had no business there. And we couldn't figure out what it was for. Like, what were we trying to stop? Because it was a civil war that was going on and we couldn't figure out why did we have to be in someone else's civil war. Thinking of dying for a question that was so unanswered was very, very scary. And then what happened was we started figuring out that kids who had money and rich families or political influence weren't going to this war. And that a lot of the people who were going were poor people or people who weren't in school. And then we began to think, well, this is completely unfair. "I ain't no senator's son" is a quote from a song that talks about, well, how come we're all for this war, but your kids aren't going? You're voting to send people to war, but your own kids are staying at home.
Some folks are born made to wave the flag. Ooh, they're red, white, and blue. And when the band plays "Hail to the Chief," ooh, they point the cannon at you.
A lot of people thought it was not fair, and that's what I had heard in the neighborhood on the streets, that those that had money would send their kids to some obscure college and they would get a college deferment. They would have to go serve their country, and it was only the poor kids, the inner city kids, the blacks and the browns that were having to go to Vietnam right away. Right after training, they would be sent to Vietnam. And when I got to Vietnam, I saw a lot of minorities, a lot of blacks from all over the country, a lot of Hispanics, a lot of poor kids. It seemed that there were a lot more really poor kids serving in Vietnam than those that were wealthy or affluent.
Contrary to popular belief, only about 25% of the troops in Vietnam were draftees. But about 3/4 of those who served came from lower middle class or working class families. Many men, like Richard Adkins, saw volunteering to go to Vietnam as a chance to do something with their lives, especially with the opportunities provided for veterans by the GI Bill.
I bucked my mom pretty good until she realized that I wouldn't have it any other way. I was at the brink of graduating from high school. I had no money, no opportunities to go to college. I didn't have any skills. I didn't have much extended family to go anywhere to do anything. It just seemed like a formula for getting into trouble, and that's not how I wanted to live. I wanted to prove myself. I wanted to become a man, a decent man. And I think for me, going into the Marine Corps was an escape, and it was an honorable escape.
African Americans made up 10% of the troops and 20% of the combat deaths in Vietnam in 1965. In America, the 1960s were a continuation of a forceful modern civil rights movement that gained momentum in the mid-1950s with events like Brown v. Board of Education and the Montgomery bus boycott. Many of our interviewees grew up in the 1950s and have powerful childhood memories of segregation and racism.
To me, I noticed the segregation in residential areas. So there'd be white neighborhoods and all black neighborhoods. So I had a friend, a little girl named Letha Quick. So one day Letha and I got the idea that I should follow her home and go to her house. Didn't tell my mother, didn't tell her mother. I was supposed to take a bus home. She was supposed to walk home. I didn't show up at home. And when I showed up at her house, her mother was terrified. I never even saw her mother. She was behind the screen door. So it was a very rundown house, no paint on the wood. Letha ran in and said, "Wait a minute, I better tell my mother." So here's a 5-year-old kid waiting outside the gate on the street, never been there before. And she asks her mother, and her mother is terrified to let this little white girl in the house. Because if anything happened, that family might be driven out of town. I didn't see her. But the answer to "Can I come in?" was no. And Letha was embarrassed. She didn't know what to do. And I was confused, so I didn't know what to do. So I said, "Okay, I should go home."
In the 1954 case, Brown v. Board of Education, the Supreme Court declared separate schools for whites and blacks unconstitutional. But even with the support of the federal government, individual mentalities changed slowly. Champaign residents recall the racial tensions that remained, even as schools were integrated.
In the elementary school, you didn't realize, you know, because people sort of treated you as people at that particular time. But things changed.
As I was leaving Champaign Central High School after our graduation, there was a graduation party that the black students were invited to. It was actually held at the Champaign Country Club. And I remember we stayed there probably 10 minutes, if that long. The atmosphere was extremely hostile. And I'm not talking about now from the students. I'm talking about from their parents. The school just represented or typified the environment that the town had.
Through most of the 1960s, the civil rights movement used a nonviolent approach to protest continued injustice, although the protesters were frequently victims of violence. The assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on April 4, 1968, ignited the nation.
I remember when Dr. King was killed, it was a shockwave went through the country, went through my neighborhood, and there, of course, was rioting and cities like Detroit was almost burned to the ground. Chicago and all the major cities, including my city, Kansas City, had rioting at the time. I remember that it was several days my mom and my brother and I were actually crawling around on the floor because there were sniper bullets coming through our apartment and in our neighborhood. One of my friends on the next block, her dad was killed when he came through the door to look out. There was a martial law declared, and so we couldn't go outside. And her father was killed on his own porch looking out the door. So it was a very scary time.
In the wake of King's assassination, the University of Illinois started Project 500, an effort to create greater racial diversity in the student body, and began actively recruiting at least 500 black and Latino students over the summer of 1968. Clarence Shelley was hired to oversee this initiative.
Well, I think King's assassination certainly energized a lot of people who were otherwise wanting to sit out the revolution or just let it happen or dissipate. I often wonder what would have happened if he had not been assassinated. For example, on this campus, the students have been negotiating with the administration for a year or so to increase the number of black students here. So the campus had agreed to admit 50 students for the summer. If they did well, they would be allowed to enroll as freshmen. Of that number, only about 16 of that 50 wanted to stay here. And these are kids who were pretty high achievers, but they were very unhappy with their summer experience. That was in 67. And in the spring, April the 4th of 1968, when King was assassinated, all hell broke loose, and the demands of our students here rose from 500 new students to 1,000. A number, they said, which represented equally the percentage of black people living in the state, this being the state university.
The University of Illinois called the initiative Project 500.
The beginning of my sophomore year was when they first started the 500 program at the university, where they brought in 500 black students, mostly underprivileged from poor neighborhoods. The problem was the university didn't really have a solid footing about what they were doing. They didn't even have rooms for some of them. They were like living in the hallway, not the hallways, but in the lounges and dorms. They weren't really prepared to have a whole bunch of people from the inner city all of a sudden show up here and try to fit in.
Most of the students that came to the University of Illinois from Project 500 were low-income students, but they were all close to the top of their classes. So even then, the students that ended up coming were high-achieving students. They were used to being active in their high schools, and so that was one piece. The students were extremely intelligent. And then you also had, which is equally as important, you had an administration that was willing to go out on the limb for those students. And so you had people at the top of the university that were sympathetic to what was being proposed as well. So when you've got that combination and when you've got those collaborations and those coalitions, I think that's one of the reasons why Project 500 was successful.
Some white students at the University of Illinois who were already involved in progressive causes were interested in supporting Project 500. However, whites often found that their help was not welcome.
I deliberately chose to live in a house where some of the Project 500 students were living because I wanted to welcome them. I was disappointed because they wouldn't talk to me when they got there, and they were complaining most of the time about being housed in inferior housing, which I was very proud of because I was trying to distance myself from our materialist culture. So I felt very proud of living in this drafty old house, but they saw it as being very demeaning. So we didn't have much of a dialogue. So I was very disappointed because I was expecting more a cross-cultural interchange. And I was anticipating being of help, but discovered they didn't need or want my help.
So often, too often, white folks who were supportive and who wanted to take care of black kids and wanted to be sure they were protected and would speak up for them and all that sort of thing, they were the same kids who were against the war. Because it became very clear that you can't be against the war and not be supportive of African-American experience or minority student issues. And the leadership of the African-American students and Latino students, their leadership, I think, made the mistake of being theatrically nasty to white people, to harass them and call them bad names. And of course, white kids would say, yes, you're right. Beat me some more, beat me some more. They weren't tough enough with them. They should have stood the ground. But I think historians and sociologists are convinced that, I'm talking now about Latino and black scholars, are convinced that without the support of the white folks, it never would have happened.
As the population of African-American students at the University of Illinois gradually grew, it became apparent that the goals and priorities of the white and black activists were not the same.
It was kind of like the difference between activism at an all-black college and activism at a white college. The Vietnam War, for example, was not a black issue at first. Black student concerns were much more personal. They wanted reactions and safeguards against violence, against police brutality, against students who have demonstrations who sit in. If the issue didn't deal with a racial problem, it didn't mean as much to them. Whereas the white kids were concerned about things like free speech, about, well, the war was a big one, the uses of recreational drugs, all that stuff. Whereas the black students' concerns had much more to do with how they were treated, how they were accepted.
To be very honest, I thought the people who were anti-war were primarily rich kids that just didn't want to inconvenience themselves by being drafted in the Army. That was my attitude at that point in time. Now, since then, I've met some of the people who were actively involved, and they were sincere about what they were doing. But from the perspective of black students, it wasn't as hot an issue for us because we felt that we were under siege as a community. And we were looking at, are we going to be able to survive here, not worrying about what's going to happen over in Vietnam?
While the Vietnam War may not have been the first priority of those dedicated to the civil rights movement, it was a major political and social issue for much of the United States. Up until Vietnam, military censorship had protected civilians from seeing the horrors of war. Instead, war had been glorified in the movies.
Fighting soldiers from the sky, fearless men who jump and die, men who mean just what they say, the brave men of the Green Beret. Put silver wings on my son's chest, make him one of America's best. He'll be a man they'll test one day. Have him win.
We didn't know anything about war, really. It was all movies. It was all John Wayne. Nobody really bled. Nobody really got hurt.
Think about it. If we were the first TV generation, we were the first ones to actually see combat on TV, real combat. We saw soldiers in Vietnam on TV. And so we could see the gore and what they would allow. We could see the bombs going off. We could see the planes. You know, we could see it from TV, from our living rooms.
You know, the photographs of children being napalmed were something you couldn't turn away from.
We were all aware of the war in particular. It was everywhere. It was on the news. And I remember when I was a kid, you'd have the news, which happened a couple times a day. It wasn't continuous. And they would say what the latest news was, and they would say what the weather was and what sports teams had won. And then they would have lists of how many Americans had been killed that day in Vietnam and how many of the so-called enemy had been killed there. It was just part of the newscast. I think we were all aware of it because we were in line to be drafted and sent over there, and we couldn't say no.
The inability to say no mobilized young people who disapproved of the United States' involvement in Vietnam. The population of young men of eligible age was concentrated in the American universities, making college campuses the centers of student protests, first against the U.S. intervention in Vietnam, and then the draft, military recruiting, defense research, and ROTC programs.
There weren't very many of us. It was really unpopular to do that. And we went out, and there were 12 of us, and we had signs, and we started walking around campus. You know what? I remembered knowing so passionately that this was wrong. Well, I was pleased that eventually, within 3 years, the moratorium came along, which was national protest. Then we had 9,000 people walking around the campus and basically shut the campus down for a strike. To see it go from the first one, 12, to 9,000, to a strike, so it built.
The anti-war movement was going on, and certainly it wasn't long before you really couldn't walk down the quad without being accosted by some anti-war organizer demanding to know where you stood on the war. It kind of ratcheted up my awareness of the government's participation in the war from an intellectual exercise about whether our reasons for being there were legitimate or illegitimate to an existential experience where you were being demanded to make a choice in no uncertain terms about where you stood on the war because there were lives at risk.
Anti-war protests started out small, but more and more students joined as the Vietnam War progressed, especially as veterans came back and added credibility to the anti-war movement by organizing as Vietnam vets against the war.
So as more vets came home and joined the movement, that kicked in the movement in a little bit higher gear. And the government was afraid of us, trained military veterans in an anti-war movement.
While some veterans identified with anti-war protests, many felt uncomfortable with their public image as they returned from Vietnam.
The general public's opinion about the war had changed. They'd gotten kind of bitter about the war, and there was an element in the public that would call Vietnam veterans baby killers and a bunch of terrible things. there wasn't a time to be proud of serving your country. I actually came home in civilian clothes when I was finally discharged, and I didn't want to wear my uniform. I didn't want people to know. I let my hair grow a little bit. I didn't want people to know that I was a soldier traveling home. So I kind of kept a low profile even after I got home.
A frequent cause of protests were recruitment sessions on campus held by companies who aided the military, including Dow Chemical Company, a maker of napalm. In the fall of 1967, University of Illinois students occupied the chemistry building for 5 hours to prevent on-campus interviews by Dow. The interviews were canceled, but 7 students were expelled.
The theme was bring the war home. We would go out and attack buildings, break windows. I mean, we just did a lot of damage. But our idea was bring in the National Guard, and then we would stop doing all our things on purpose, and the National Guard would pack up and leave town, and then we'd start the next day, and they'd bring the National Guard back. I mean, you know, we're really strategic because we were really decided that if we caused enough trouble, they might, you know, end the war.
So they felt they could throw rocks at Follett's bookstore with impunity or, you know, trash the businesses on Green Street. A protester would hurl an insult at a policeman, and most policemen really didn't have a lot of training in how to deal with student dissenters. They would be quick-tempered, too, and they'd start shouting things about how their son was in Vietnam, and they didn't want to hear any more crap, you know, students who didn't know anything. It was quick to escalate. Many in the movement did buy this philosophy that we really needed to go beyond just protesting, holding up placards, and we needed to be more targeted in our protests. At the same time, they became more violent as students felt that the ends justified the means. You know, we must stop the war at all costs.
Other demonstrations got so out of control that administrators called in the National Guard.
At the time that they were here, they were very visible, and as I said, it made a big impact on whether you can get across campus, and they had a curfew for a while, and the National Guard was enforcing it. I did feel sorry for them. They were often the same age as the students were, just put in a different position. I'm assuming lots of them were against the war too, but they were in uniform and they had to do a job. So I'm sure a lot of them were in conflict too.
There was a very serious protest on the campus. The National Guard was actually called to the campus at that point. So I can't say that they were not serious about what they were doing, but I do remember one of the comments that the local law enforcement made when those students were out on the streets. Basically, he said to the students, see if you can find smaller rocks to throw. And that really struck me because what it told me is he sees those students as part of him, and he's not trying to hurt them. If I were out there, he would be trying to hurt me. Even going through that counterculture phase, if you will, I always knew that there was this race piece that was still unresolved, even in the hippie movement.
Nowhere was the racial divide more evident than in the reactions to 2 student shootings in May of 1970, when the National Guard killed 2 African-American students and wounded 12 others at Jackson State College in Mississippi. The event passed quickly out of the media. But when 4 white students were shot by the National Guard at Kent State University in Ohio, people were shocked.
I don't really remember the specific day, but everyone is horrified that the National Guard would open fire on a group of unarmed students who are peacefully protesting. Is obviously horrifying and obviously wrong. That was a turning point where I think more than just hippies and young people could see that there was something seriously wrong and that it had to change. And in many ways, that was the turning of public sentiment, and that was the beginning of the end of the war.
I can still see immediately the vision of the people with their hands covered with blood on the sidewalk crying over the people who had been shot. And it was very scary here as well. There was a professor that I knew who was just beaten bloody by state police officers. And there was one demonstration that happened west of the football stadium. And all of a sudden, buses filled with state police officers were unloaded at one end, and they got out with these big clubs and they started moving directly east and pushing all the students ahead of them. I mean, there were numbers of people who got really severely hurt. So the question became, would they unpop their weapons and boom, 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 would that happen?
And that would have been 1970, which was my first year at Uni High. And yeah, we were all very aware of what was going on. There were a lot of protests and there was a lot of rioting and so forth. And I can recall walking down Green Street and there were no windows in any of the storefronts. All the windows had been smashed out. There was glass everywhere. Cars turned upside down. Some of them had, as I recall, been burned. And you'd sort of never knew when things might go out of control. I remember driving by the Assembly Hall parking lot and just seeing the parking lot completely filled with personnel carriers, Jeeps, National Guard stuff. So there were times where we couldn't get out of the school because of all the military and police and that kind of stuff.
And that went on for about the whole month of May. I mean, it was like not even being in school. But there was a fear. That's when the parents got on the phone and said, you ain't going there anymore. I'll pull your money away. And so between that May of 1970 and the fall of 70, the anti-war movement virtually disappeared except a very, very, very hardcore group of kids all over the country.
Yeah, my mother wasn't very happy with me. I remember mistakenly telling her what I was doing on campus in a letter, and she wrote me something, and I still remember the quote. It was, put down your picket sign and pick up your books.
By the time President Richard Nixon ordered the first troops to withdraw from Vietnam in June of 1969, the war had become largely unpopular. Nixon had National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger meet with representatives from North Vietnam to come to an agreement. In 1973, the Paris Peace Accords officially ended U.S. involvement in Vietnam.
And so happy Christmas!
Although the anti-war movement gradually lost momentum as the Vietnam War wound down, it did not disappear until the war was completely over. As young people shifted their focus away from Vietnam, counterculture businesses and community organizations flourished in Champaign-Urbana.
Oh, wow. This was hippie heaven. You wouldn't know it now, but the block where the Krannert Center is and the Spurlock Museum, all those things, those two blocks, those were all hippie houses in those two blocks. And the university hated it. It was just too close for comfort. And that's one of the reasons why those things were eventually knocked down and the university bought up the property and puts up, you know, university buildings, right? They did that all over the place. On the corner of Daniels and 6th, where the Speech and Hearing Science building is, there used to be a head shop there. It was still there in 1972, a head shop being kind of like a hippie kind of drug paraphernalia and stuff like that. There was underground newspapers here that were published here in 1972. The anti-war movement on campus, even though the anti-war movement nationally was beginning to dissipate, the movement was still big enough to fill the Fullinger Auditorium with anti-war rallies at that point in 1972. So, yeah, there was a lot of stuff, and there was a lot of things just going on campus and in the community, actually. There was also a connection between the campus and the community that doesn't exist anymore. I miss the hippie houses. Those were cool. Just walking up and down those streets and seeing people sitting out on the porches and playing music and, you know, just having a great time. It was a totally different world.
Earthworm 2, a self-described free people community directory, provided information about the various countercultural businesses and services in the local community. It describes Champaign-Urbana in this way.
Nestled somewhere in the Illinois prairie, between the cornfields and the cow dung, is a quickly growing pair of small towns called Champaign-Urbana. Some know it as the home of the University of Illinois and the Fighting Illini. Others know it as the armpit of the nation, with its sweat running heavily through the Boneyard Creek. And some call it home, and enjoy the arching trees of Green Street and the small town atmosphere, sitting on the front porch swing listening to the birds and rapping with friends. But in the last 3 years, Champaign-Urbana has taken on another identity. A few hundred of its residents have taken on the task of building a counter-community.
after the anti-war movement died down, here's what you had. You had thousands of young people who smoked marijuana and did other drugs, who were into the sexual revolution and who wore their hair long and, you know, were anti-society. And they didn't know where to go with that. It was a new culture. They couldn't go back. They weren't going to cut their hair, put on a suit, stop smoking dope, and just act like nothing happened. You don't do that in your life because there's values. And they were very radical about the values. And always there had been this kind of hippie counterculture undercurrent that kind of combined with the political stuff. There was kind of a tension between that because the political people sometimes say, hey, why are you smoking a joint instead of coming and protesting the war? But after the anti-war movement died, then all that was left was the counterculture. So in a way to kind of preserve that culture, people said, well, we'll just build an alternative America. And what does America do? They make money. They're capitalists. They build businesses. So we'll start our own.
Victor Fine was a leader in the Champaign-Urbana counterculture movement. In 1971, he started a restaurant called Metamorphosis as part of a large collective called Earthworks, which housed many co-ops.
People really couldn't imagine having a hippie restaurant. They didn't want one in town because they didn't believe we'd be clean enough. Then it became a collective. And I invited people, if you have an idea for a collective, then talk to us about, you know, renting some space. So we broke up the rent as co-ops came in. And over time, there was a lot of co-ops. There was a food co-op, and then there was a custom clothing store. There was a co-op. There was a tropical fish store. There was a co-op. There was a electronic repair shop. There was a bicycle repair shop. There was a automobile repair shop out in the garage. So it obviously, through that and through the restaurant, it became a cultural center. So hippies and counterculture, as well as what we called straight people from the community that were enamored by being able to view us in action and use our stores, they started being involved too, which is exactly what we wanted, and our ways and conversations with them, and they could find out that we weren't just these things they imagined as being grossly dirty and crazy with drugs and, you know, all their stereotypes.
Victor Fine's restaurant, Metamorphosis, was one such place. The menu consisted of vegetarian dishes, natural meat dishes, homemade desserts, and late-night munchies.
And I remember my whole family going there, which was a little funny because it was everybody else eating brown rice and this and that. And then it was mom and dad and two kids. You know, my dad in a giant purple and gold. My dad was colorblind, so a sort of psychedelic-looking tie that was about the width of a tablecloth. You know, all of us in our sort of Brady Bunch attire, you know. But we were used to traveling. We'd go to other countries, and rather than, you know, then going to the American restaurant, we wanted to go in and see what the other culture was about. And I think to my parents, to a certain extent, this was just another interesting new culture that they could learn about and they could be a part of and they could travel. So they didn't feel self-conscious.
The restaurant was called Metamorphosis. There was this empty space next to it, and a bunch of friends and I said, let's clean up this space and make a free store. So we cleaned up the space, and we asked people, bring stuff you don't want and come and take stuff that you need. It was just a place where you could just exchange stuff. So it was getting into the mindset that there's all this stuff. Why not share it, and why not let other people partake in your wealth rather than toss it or try and sell it? Let's just be free and all this kind of stuff.
And then there were various other places. There was the People's Gas and Repair, which was a hippie garage. There was Earthworks Garage, which was another hippie garage. You know, they'd fix VW Beetles and VW buses and, you know, all the things that hippies would drive. Then the Strawberry Fields, which is still exists, but started as a collective. And, you know, you'd go in there, look at all the odd organic food.
Let me take you down. I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever.
The counterculture movement's emphasis on equality and community involvement inspired many new businesses to operate as cooperatives. To this day, the Common Ground Food Co-op in Urbana functions on this principle. The co-op was founded in 1974 to provide food to low-income residents living in the community. It was initially structured as a buying club, with an emphasis on economic accessibility, including the door-to-door delivery of groceries for those with limited mobility. The work was handled entirely by volunteers.
There was only one grocery store in the neighborhood, and they would not consider working with the people who lived in the neighborhood. The reason? The neighborhood was made up of people who lived below the poverty level. And they weren't interested in that clientele. Now, the neighborhood was made up of about 60% were graduate students living on very low income. Then about 20% were retirees. And then about 10% were African Americans, all of whom were trying to live under extreme economic pressure. So that was why they needed an alternative food supply system. And we went to IGA to see if they would be interested in starting a grocery store someby close, and they said no. So it looked like we were running into a blind alley on that. Then a guy by the name of Jones, Marvin Jones, stopped into my office one day about 4 o'clock and said, I hear you're trying to find an alternative food supply system. And I said, yeah. He says, I've got the answer. We can start a co-op. So he agreed to help me start the food co-op if we could find 21 people who would join. And to join meant you had to pay $3. And that meant that you could buy at wholesale prices marked up by 10%, which is a lot lower than you can get at a grocery store anywhere. And we worked on that for about 6 months. We finally found 21 people who would sign in, and so we had a start. And Marvin came in and said, okay, Jim, it's time we go to St. Louis to the warehouses down there to buy our first food supply. And so that's how the food co-op got started. Marvin also ran a newspaper in town, which was called the Common Ground Newspaper. So that's how the food co-op is now known as the Common Ground Food Co-op.
Today, Common Ground still runs as a cooperative with people choosing to buy ownership. Long before Common Ground, there was an organization in Urbana called the Channing Murray Foundation. For the last 104 years, it has promoted the values of the Unitarian Universalists.
I got involved in the Channing Murray Foundation, which was at that time the kind of focus of civil rights activity on the campus. And after a while, that morphed into being anti-war activity. So it was really exciting. The minister, who's named Jack Taylor, he was going down every weekend down to Selma, Alabama, or some other hot spot. And then he would come back up and he would tell the congregation all this really up-to-the-minute, really exciting stuff about what was going on. And it was very inspiring.
The Channing Murray Foundation also runs a vegetarian restaurant called The Red Herring. In the 1960s and 70s, it offered a place on the University of Illinois campus for dancing, drama, meetings, films, and good music. It served as a hub of countercultural activities.
Our main philosophy was of openness and allowing all ideas to be heard. So our idea running the Red Herring was allow anybody to come in and say anything and you know, be very open about it. So like we had free speech nights when we would just... Basically, I would usually be the moderator, and I just get up on stage and I just recognize people, out of the audience, and people would say different things. It was kind of like a chat room.
It was like a radical hotbed. But anyway, in the basement of that, we started our little, what we call the war room, and we would put out 10,000 mimeographed newsletters, and then we would take them unasked, armloads of them. We had hundreds of students. We would just go in the dorms, and we would just drop them at the door. And the university was going crazy because they didn't know. And the more we did that, the more people read it, you know, the more the consciousness was growing. Poor people thought we were cool. You know, we had long hair and stuff. And so, you know, it just began to build. So every time we'd have protests, more and more people would join.
Creating an informed public was important to many in the counterculture movement.
They wanted to bring issues to light and provide the community with the information they needed to make decisions for themselves.
A bunch of people decided that there was only one game in town in terms of the news, and we needed to change that along with everything else we thought we were going to change. So we started a community newspaper, and we did everything. We wrote about issues that we felt were of interest to the alternative community. We talked about natural foods and environmental things, which at the time was of little concern, seemingly, to the people who were around us. And when Richard Nixon came to speak in Pekin, Illinois, we went there with our press passes and were right up front with the press. It was just amazing to be these kind of little people from the Prairie Dispatch getting ready to stand right next to the president.
Just as the Prairie Dispatch actively sought to raise social awareness, many alternative businesses did the same. The Record Service was a business devoted to selling music that was often beyond the mainstream. The Earthworm Directory called it the most successful counter-economic institution in the community.
I was working at WPGU. I lived in a house with three other guys. Two of them were in student government. And they said, oh, we talked about this idea of having this record ordering service. And they said, would you be interested in helping? And I said, yeah, sure. You know, that sounds like a wonderful idea. And for an initial investment of about $1.25, we bought a Schwann catalog, a pencil, and a notebook, and would sit there. And people would come in and say, this is the record I want. You look it up, you write it down. And then every day or two, we would call in this distributor out of Chicago, and they would ship them down. At the time, an album would list price at $4.98, and most stores would actually sell them at $4.98. We found that you could buy them for like $2.60, and we would sell them for like $2.99. We figured we didn't have to make any money. You know, we worked out of the student government office, which is why we were called originally the Undergraduate Student Association Record Ordering Service, which was shortened to UGSA Record Service. And eventually we became separate from student government, and then we were just Record Service. And even though we tried for years to come up with a different, better name, we could never agree on one. So we were just Record Service forever, even when we weren't selling records anymore.
There was a chain music store called Discount Records that was right around the corner from the Record Service, but they sold their products at much higher prices. So people quickly figured out that as an alternative, it was really a good idea to buy it at a place that was selling it for cheaper. And what was interesting was they might not have had the philosophy. They might not have cared about the fact that the money that was made off the records was going to be used to support a place like Francis Nelson Health Center. But they came to that store anyway because of the product. I will tell you something very unusual about a place like the Record Service. There was a group called the Grateful Dead, which was a big alternative band. In 1972, on the day that the Grateful Dead's big album came out, the Record Service closed for about an hour and a half so that all the people who worked at the store could listen to the album first. And this was a very unusual business practice that would allow for a business just to say, well, wait a minute, we have to hear this music before we start selling it. So they just closed the doors. And there was a big line of people, I remember, standing outside and snaking down the street waiting to get in so that they could shop. But as you can see, that's a very unusual way to try to run a business. And after a period of time, they weren't able to sustain those types of practices and stay in business.
The Record Service, which started as a collective, a student collective, became a real store. But it was the cultural center of my life, I guess, because I would go there and there was this magical place and there were all these weird-looking people that I thought were really cool. And there was incense and some crazy music playing. And it was my favorite thing, to just go there and look through at all the record covers, you know, which were big, big pictures of people. They were all windows into other worlds. And then there'd be something crazy playing and I could go up to the hippie at the counter and say, what is this? And, you know, they say, that's Bob Marley. Wow, Bob Marley, you know, reggae, crazy, you know, and for $3 you could buy the record, and that was an entire culture that would open up. Let me hear you say,
that's the other part of hippiedom, drug abuse, drug use, drug experimentation, finding alternative consciousness through chemicals. And yes, everybody did some of that. And whether they were hallucinogens, opiates, depressants or stimulants, they could have consequences. And being that experimentation can be controlled so that you can learn from that experience is one thing, but abuse of a drug is an entirely different thing.
I was with a group of friends who were taking LSD. We went to Allerton. I wasn't doing anything, so I was the driver. So I drove them out there, and everything was kind of going along okay, and they just started getting weirder and weirder. At some point, they decided that the park around Sensinger was a map of the universe, and they knew how it all worked. Everybody just started getting weirder and weirder. They're all, like, walking around the sculpture backwards, and they're not really very responsive. And I start thinking, I probably better get these people home. So I put them in the car, and it's just getting weirder and weirder. And they basically were all having a bad drug trip. And I'm trying to figure out who's in the worst shape and talk them down or calm them or whatever. And finally, you know, we actually had a kind of a hippie helpline for people who are having problems. My one friend was, you know, yelling and screaming and rolling around the floor and thrashing and no Vietnam. And so I call the hotline. The guy says, well, sounds like I'd better come over. So, and he comes and he's got the little, you know, wire rim glasses and a big beard and the hippie clothes. And he knew the guy who was having the problems. He said, hey, how are you doing? The guy looks at him and he says, this is afterbirth. You must be Nemo, which didn't make any sense to me at the time. And then later I realized that there was a hippie commune. It was a hippie commune. It was called the Afterbirth Farm. There was a band called Afterbirth. Nemo was probably one of the hippie people. He was just trying to figure it out.
The Hippie Helpline describes the service of Gemini House. Located in Champaign, Gemini House started in late 1970 and grew into a multi-purpose, community-oriented collective. It provided education about drugs, counseling, referrals to mental health agencies, and emergency drug rescue. It also served as a crash pad for people passing through town who needed a place to stay.
So what we were dealing with was the number of people who were being hospitalized, who were being injured, who were being suicidal, who were flipping out on LSD, your acid trip, and ending up in a jail cell and then really becoming emotionally damaged by that experience. And so it was a crisis intervention center.
It wasn't all sex, drugs, and rock and roll. There were serious things happening. The other stuff was happening too, but there were serious things that were happening. Everybody was doing different things, and you know, it was much broader than what you see in a lot of the documentaries.
We were going through a transition of, you know, being a teenager and growing up at the time that really the American society was going through a transition growing up. There was an awful lot of change in the air, and you know, it's different when you look back on it and you know how things are going to come out and what's going to happen. But when you're living it, there's the uncertainty of, you know, what direction is it going to go? Is everything going to become a peace and love utopia and we're all going to be living together in collective farms and it's going to be fantastic and it's going to be peace and love and taking care of the environment? You know, for a while it almost looked like it would. For a little while after Woodstock, it almost looked like maybe all of this change was heading in a place and the counterculture would become the culture.
By the time we got to Woodstock, we were half a million strong. And then we were on the song and a celebration.
The counterculture movement was a large part of many people's lives. Although it appears to have died down, those who were involved can trace its impact in the way they view issues and interact with others, even today. For better or worse, it radically changed America in the 1960s and 70s.
We are stars. We are gods. We are caught in the devil's bargain. And we got to get ourselves back to the garden.
I think it did change things. Counterculture, of course, always becomes the mainstream culture. I think that's the way it always happens. And that's what has happened. And, of course, things change gradually, bit by bit. I think if we had a draft today and people had to be drafted to go to the wars that we've had recently, that we might have more protests on campus. In fact, I would say we probably most definitely would. We might have another kind of movement. I think what happens is that, as I said, counterculture becomes mainstream.
My sister and I We were saying how fortunate we've been in order to live through all of the turmoil and successes that have gone on. And you notice I put turmoil and successes in the same frame of mind because there have been turmoil, but there's also been so many successes that we've been fortunate enough to experience as we've grown. Not only to experience it, but to fight. You asked me, what did we fight for? I think we fought for everything.
I think the major change has been in the assumptions of the campus environment. Black students are no longer seen as outsiders. And I think that's a very important distinction, because that means that black students don't feel as if they're outsiders. And the reason why they don't is because there are offices like the Office of Minority Student Affairs or the African American Culture Center or some of the student organizations that exist in housing. So all of those offices and all of those organizations were actually put in place by the students from 1968.
I like the fact that the world is constantly opening new doors. What we have to make sure is that it doesn't close some at the same time, and that's hard.
Everything turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And there are time to every purpose.
Most of us go through different phases of life that carries us away from some of the experiences that we have. But I still feel alternative in my mind. Let's put it that way. I did some work for my adult career that didn't seem alternative, but the way I approached my work did. I felt like I brought my mindset from that period of time with me. And from that period in time during the late 60s and early 70s, I developed a philosophy which I haven't rejected. I don't feel like I ever turned my back on the person I became during that period of time.
It just arose, and I was where I was at that particular time. And so all those circumstances happened to be there when I was at a particular age, at a particular circumstance, and I stepped into it, and I bought it. You know, it became me. And I believed in it with all my heart.
To everything turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn.
We hope you enjoyed Beyond the Tie-Dye, Counterculture in Champaign-Urbana, 1965 to 1975. This program was produced by University Laboratory High School students Aishwarya Gautam, Shruti Vaidya, and Sarah Yaki, with help from Mary Campbell, Alice Chang, Amalia Dolan, Mara Dolan, Linus Erbach, Gloria Ha, Alice Hu, Anna Canfer, Sunday Koshi, Bissy Michael, Laura Landich, Nafisa Syed, and Jonathan Yaki. Interviews were conducted by students from the Union High Class of 2015. Stories were contributed by Richard Atkins, Nathaniel Banks, Debbie Cox, Bern Fine, Victor Fine, Catherine Gorski, Penny Hanna, James Holloman, Joseph Miller, Renee Pollack, Mark Grubel, Howie Shine, Clarence Shelley, Phil Strange, Esther Suggs, and Bill Taylor. This program was directed by Dave Dickey of Illinois Public Media and Janet Morford of University Laboratory High School. For more information on this project, visit our website at illinoisyouthmedia.org. I'm Shruti Vaidya.
I'm Sarah Yaki.
And I'm Aishwarya Gautam.
To everything turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to gain, a time to lose, a time to rend, a time to sow, a time for love, a time for hate, a time for peace. I swear it's not too late.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, host of NPR's On Point. You know, it sounds simple enough, but an honest conversation is a rare and wonderful thing. That's what we work for here. That's our ambition every day, an honest conversation between people trying to make sense of the world. Come join us for the next On Point.
Monday through Friday night from 9 to 11 on AM 580. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.